Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, it's Monday, July 15th, 2024. I'm Arlene Ford, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and New York Times with me today is Lou Marendo. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of the Hartford Courant. And there are five photos. The first, well, the major photo on the front page is that of a gentleman sitting on a bench in Mystic, and he's wearing a light blue T-shirt, dark shorts, and tan boat shoes, and he's sipping a cup of coffee. But the interesting part of this photo is sitting on his knee is a macaw, and that's a bird, and his bird is breast is like a gold color, and the rest of him is green, very colorful. And the caption reads, Larry Gormick of New London enjoys a cup of coffee with his pet, Mickey the Cowboy Macaw, a 17-year-old blue and gold macaw, as he sits on a bench enjoying a quiet day in downtown Mystic on Wednesday. Mickey performs for parties and events and goes everywhere with Larry. And the next photo is that of a police officer at an accident scene involving a motorcycle. And in this one, you see the cones where they put up on the street. You see the crashed motorcycle, and there's the policeman kneeling with a flashlight examining the motorcycle. The next photo, there are two and they're related, has to do with Higher Hartford, and that's basically an organization that recruits training for individuals as submarine construction is about to expand. And in this photo, we're seeing a welder as he is doing welding a piece of equipment at Electric Boat. And then we're looking at the submarine, the nuclear attack submarine, the Virginia, as it sits in a graving dock at the shipyard of Electric Boat in Groton, and this was in 2003. And we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. And then the next photo we're looking at has to do with the new trade board as it looks to do business overseas. And in this photo, we see Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney and of New Haven, and then Senator Bob Duff of Norwalk, and they're both dressed in business suits. They are both strong supporters of trade with Ireland and are choosing members of a 23-member trade commission. And we'll be doing a story later on in the broadcast on that. Now it's time for Lou to go over the photos on the front page of the New York Times.
Hello. Today we'll be reading from the New York Times issue for Monday, July 15th, 2024, and we'll look at the front the pictures on the front page of the New York Times. And of course, the big story this week is the attempted assassination of Donald Trump when he was making a campaign speech in Butler, Pennsylvania. Now, Butler, Pennsylvania is due north of Pittsburgh. This is western Pennsylvania. Now, the first big picture is obviously a picture from a drone of the area that the speech was being given in. And we're talking basically an open field with some outbuildings. And there was a stage and bleachers surrounding it. And then below the stage, there was a number of seats that the people were sitting in. There was bleachers on both sides of the stage. And then when you look at the whole picture, you can see a building remotely to the left of the stage that's about 300 feet, 400 feet away from the stage that the sniper was on the roof. And then there's a building behind the stage where the law enforcement snipers were located to protect the president, not the president, the former president. And and then other buildings surrounding the whole thing. But the secure area was actually the fairgrounds that this stage was located in. And you can clearly see that the sniper was a distance away. They also show you the locations of the people in the audience that were also shot, and they were below actually the stage. So it was, I guess there was like six or eight shots made, and there were people a distance away from the president, former president, who were also shot. And we'll have stories on this throughout the day and this morning. Then there's a small picture of a frontal view of Donald Trump standing behind the podium, turning to his right with his right hand up in the air. And he is making a point at the very beginning of his speech. And this is a photograph that showed up last night in the news. There was a photographer from the New York Times who was snapping pictures throughout the speech. And one of the pictures actually shows a bullet passing by Donald Trump. And it's you can see it over his left shoulder. And it in the you can't see it that clearly in the newspaper, but on a TV picture, you can clearly see the trackings of a bullet about 6 inches from the president. And this was probably one of the bullets that missed. Then we go below the fold, and we have two other pictures. One is that of Richard Simmons. Now, Richard Simmons was a popular fitness instructor that made national news in the 70s and 80s. He was very commonly seen on talk shows and everything, and he always wore his patented shorts and T-shirts promoting physical fitness. He passed away at the age of 76. We'll have a story there. And the last picture is that from Wimbledon in England, and there's a picture of the winner of the championship. His name is Carlos Alcaraz, and he beat Novak Djokovic in straight sets to win his second Wimbledon title in 2 years. And he's only 20 years old. And that's it for the pictures on the front page of the New York Times. Let's go back to Arlene for the lead story.
Shooting shakes both campaigns. Trump ups security, still set to open RNC, Dems pull ads and drives. The assassination attempt of former President Donald Trump at his rally Saturday in Pennsylvania plunged the 2024 presidential race into a state of shock and uncertainty. President Joe Biden's campaign raced to pull his television ads off the airwaves nationwide and paused all official outbound communications. No fundraising appeals, no news releases. An internal Biden campaign edict asked all staff members to refrain from issuing any comments on social media or in public, as did similar internal guidance from the Trump campaign. Biden, who was in church at the time of the shooting, condemned the violence as sick in a brief address to the nation from a local police department in Delaware, changing plans and returning to the White House after midnight. He and Trump spoke late Saturday, a call that a White House official described as good, respectful, and brief. Trump issued his own graphic recounting of the searing moment in a social media post. I heard a whizzing sound, shots, and immediately felt the bullet ripping through the skin as he returned to New Jersey before the Republican National Convention that officials said would continue as planned Monday in Milwaukee. I will never surrender, Trump wrote in text message to supporters. His top two advisors, Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, wrote in a public statement Saturday night that Trump would still be joining his supporters at the convention. And in an internal message to Trump campaign staff, they wrote that they were enhancing the armed security presence with 24/7 officers on site at the Washington and West Palm Beach, Florida campaign offices. LaCivita, in a text message Sunday, said the assassination attempt would not alter convention planning. Changes nothing, he said. Of course, the shooting did change the complexion of the race. But in the immediate aftermath, questions surrounding how it will play out politically generated far more speculation than answers. What was certain is that the nation is confronting a new the ugly and rising tide of violence in American politics. The shooting came at what already felt like a deeply consequential crossroads in a 2024 campaign that has had its fair share of them. Trump this year became the first former president convicted of felonies. Biden has been besieged by his fellow Democrats as the party's standard bearer ever since a faltering debate more than 2 weeks ago. And Trump is preparing to name his running mate and formally claim his party's nomination for the third consecutive election. But all of that paled in the comparison to the first shooting of a current or former president since President Ronald Reagan in 1981.
From the New York Times, Gunman's Motive Sought as Trump Vows to Go to RNC, by Michael Scheer, Glenn Trush, Peter Baker, and Michael Levinson. Investigators searched on Sunday for a motive that could explain why a 20-year-old armed with a AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle shot at former President Donald Trump just days before he was to accept the Republican nomination for president. The assassination attempt, which wounded Mr. Trump and killed one of his supporters, was being treated by the FBI as a possible act of domestic terrorism, and it immediately raised questions about why the Secret Service and other law enforcement agencies had not secured a nearby building outside the large outdoor venue where Mr. Trump held his rally. The gunman apparently climbed onto the building's rooftop with a rifle and fired multiple times, wounding Mr. Trump just minutes into his speech on a sweltering Saturday afternoon in Butler, Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh. Within moments, someone shouted, "Shoot her down," and Security Service, agitated but in control, began moving Mr. Trump off stage to safety. "Wait, wait, wait," he called out. He then made a point of pumping his fist at the crowd and seemed to defiantly shout, "Fight, fight," the moment captured in photos that showed Mr. Trump's fist held high, his cheek bloody with the American flag behind him, roused Mr. Trump's stunned supporters who broke out in chants of USA. Mr. Trump was taken to the hospital on Saturday night, but was able to walk off his plane unaided when it landed in New Jersey hours later. On Sunday, he vowed to remain defiant in the face of wickedness and flew to Milwaukee for the start of the Republican National Convention on Monday, saying he would not let assassination attempt change his scheduling or anything else. The gunman, who was identified by the FBI as Thomas Matthew Crooks of Bethel Park, Pennsylvania, a Pittsburgh suburb, was killed by the Secret Service, the agency said. Law enforcement officials later found a possible rudimentary explosive device in his car, Paul Abbey, deputy director of the FBI, said. An AR-15-type semi-automatic rifle found next to Mr. Crooks' body had been bought by Mr. Crooks' father, the FBI said. It was not clear if he had given Mr. Crooks the weapon or if Mr. Crooks had taken it without permission. The gunman did not have a criminal history in Pennsylvania's public court records. A voter registration record showed that he had registered as a Republican. Federal campaign finance records also show he donated $15 to the Progressive Turnout Project, a liberal voter turnout group, through the Democratic donation platform Act Blue in 2021. Mr. Crooks worked as a dietary aide at a nursing home in his hometown, according to Marcy Grimm, the facility's administrator. She said that the employees were shocked to learn that he was the gunman, saying Mr. Crooks had performed his job without concern and his background check was clear. Speaking to the nation for the third time since the shooting, Mr. Biden said that the nation needed to lower the temperature in our politics.
Connecticut politicians condemn political violence. Connecticut politicians offered well wishes to former President Donald Trump and a vehement condemnation of violence following an assassination attempt Saturday at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. In a social media post, Trump said he was shot with a bullet that pierced the upper part of my right ear. The former president was quickly whisked from the stage by Secret Service agents, his ear covered in blood. The FBI early Sunday named Thomas Matthew Crooks, 20, of Bethel Park, Pennsylvania, as the shooter in the assassination attempt on Trump. The agency said the investigation remains active and ongoing. The former president confirmed he'll attend the Republican National Convention despite being injured in the shooting. Governor Ned Lamont said violence of any kind has no place in our society. Political violence and gun violence of any kind have absolutely no place in our society and are never acceptable, he said in a statement. We must all as Americans be able to express our views freely and without the fear of violence. My thoughts are with former President Trump and everyone in attendance at today's rally, and I am relieved that everyone appears to be safe, Lamont added. I also commend the U.S. Secret Service and law enforcement for their swift action to protect everyone's safety. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy echoed Lamont's statement. There is no room in America for political violence, Murphy said in a statement on X. We should all condemn what happened today, and I am hoping for the health of the former president and everyone else at the rally. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal tweeted, political violence of any kind is unacceptable. I am thankful for law enforcement's swift response. My thoughts are with former President Trump. U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat 3, commended the quick response of law enforcement in a statement posted on X. My thoughts and prayers are with former President Donald Trump and his family after hearing news of a shooting at his campaign rally today, DeLauro said. I commend the quick response of the Secret Service and other law enforcement officials on scene. U.S. Representative Johanna Haines, Democrat from the 5th District, condemned the cowardly act and sent prayers to Trump. This is not how policy differences are settled in the United States of America, Haines said in a statement on social media. U.S. Representative John B. Larson, District 1, said, thank God President Trump is safe and being treated. Our prayers and thoughts are with him, his family, and all those in attendance at the rally, Larson said. We thank the Secret Service and law enforcement for acting quickly and condemn all forms of violence.
Israel airstrike attempted to kill a Hamas leader and a key lieutenant by Rowan Bergman and Patrick Kingsley, and this is out of Tel Aviv. For weeks, Israel kept watch on a palm tree-dotted villa in southern Gaza where it believed a top Hamas lieutenant was staying with his family, but it held off a strike, according to three senior Israeli defense officials. The Israelis had a bigger target in mind, Mohammed Diaf, the elusive leader of Hamas military wing. On Saturday, after learning that Mr. Diaf appeared to be at the villa, the officials said the Israeli government sent in fighter jets and devastated the compound and killed dozens of Palestinians in the area around it. The Israeli military and the Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency, said on Sunday that the strike had killed the lieutenant Rafa Salameh. But the fate of Mr. Diaf, who is second in command of Hamas and considered an architect of its October 7th attack on Israel, remained unclear. He has survived other assassination attempts. The Israeli government also defended the decision to order the strike, which the officials said used at least five U.S.-made precision-guided bombs in an area Israeli itself has designated as a humanitarian zone for Palestinians driven from their homes by the war between Israel and Hamas. The strike was authorized after a prolonged observations of the villa, one of Mr. Shalap's secret command posts, according to the three senior Israeli officers. The villa west of Khan Yunus, near the Mediterranean Sea, belonged to Mr. Shalap's family, two of the officials said, and Mr. Shalap began spending more time there in recent months after Israeli forces overran many of his strongholds in Khan Yunus, both above and below ground, according to two of the officials. All the officials spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly about details of the operation. Mr. Shalaf still spent much of his time in Hamas underground tunnel network, but he was also staying regularly at the villa along with his family and other militants to escape the stifling conditions in the tunnels.
We will return with more front pages after this break for the weather. National forecast. Thunderstorms across the northern Midwest may bring flash flooding, hail, and damaging wind gusts. There may be isolated tornadoes in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. Farther east, thunderstorms will rumble across the northeast. An area of high pressure anchored over the Rocky Mountains will promote very hot weather and spotty afternoon thundershowers. Many places will challenge daily record high temperatures and even challenge all-time records. In the southeast, it will be a very warm and humid, and afternoon thunderstorms could dot the Gulf Coast states. Along the middle Atlantic and northeast coast, the heat wave will continue with temperatures above average. Cool and cloudy weather will roll along the coast of the Pacific Northwest.
Guidepost Magazine is on Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday mornings at 7:30 on Chris.
Now for our local forecast. Monday, high 93, low 72, hot, humid, a heavy thunderstorm late in the afternoon. Tuesday, high 96, low 75, record-tying heat and humidity. On Wednesday, high 94, low 70, a severe afternoon thunderstorm, otherwise hot and humid. Thursday, high 83, low 66, mostly cloudy and hot, not as hot, rather, excuse me. Friday, high 84, low 64, sunshine and patchy clouds.
Welcome back to Front Pages for Monday, July 15th, 2024. And from the New York Times comes the story, Saudi money makes a big splash in the flashy video game industry by Eli Tan. The fans flooded through the streets of Reykjavik, Saudi Arabia, by the thousands, kept cool by mist machines in the 110-degree heat. A 30-foot-tall model gold trophy towered over onlookers at the city center. For a moment, covered in beams of brightly colored light, a country defined by tradition looked futuristic. It was the inaugural Esports World Cup, a coming-out party for Saudi Arabia's growing video game industry. As part of its plan to diversify its economy, the Saudi government has said it will invest $38 billion in video games by 2030 through the public investment fund known as PIF, a wealth fund that manages $700 billion. The wealth behind the commitment was on full display in Reykjavik, Saudi's capital, this week. But the country's influence in video games extends far beyond its borders. In what has been a financially difficult year for the industry, which has been mass layoffs, many of the world's largest video game companies and influencers have quietly partnered with the oil-rich Saudis. Through acquisitions, a company funded by the PIF called Savvy Games Group now owns 40% of the total esports market share, a representative said. Esports are video games played by professional gamers in competitive tournaments. The PIF and its subsidiaries have spent roughly $6 billion buying up game companies and $14 billion in stock investments. Some critics have labeled investments game washing, an attempt to polish the country's reputation and human rights abuses with entertainment and tourism, as it has been accused of doing with its professional golf and soccer leagues. Some gamers have denounced the country's involvement and vowed to boycott its events, and it can be jarring for visitors to see women, some of them in elaborate costumes, working at a conference in a country where women's rights have historically been and continue to be very restricted. But as Saudi money becomes ubiquitous in the esports world, avoiding it has become difficult. Some esports teams are trying to make a social statement while accepting Saudi cash. Team Liquid, an esports team known for its promoting diversity and inclusion in the sport, wore jerseys with Pride logo during competition. Its leaders had mulled over whether it meant to play in Reykjavik in the weeks leading up to the tournament. Some influencers tried to justify their participation to their fans on social media. Joshua Hard, a sportscaster for the tournament, said in a 10-day contract with the Esports World Cup will account for 20 to 30% of his annual earnings. When you see an opportunity come along that way, it's really hard to say no. And I don't begrudge anyone for saying no or being upset that I'm here.
Black town in Louisiana split on growth. Twin sisters Joe and Dr. Joy Banner live just miles from where their ancestors were enslaved more than 200 years ago in St. John the Baptist Parish, Louisiana. Their tidy Creole cottage cafe in the small riverfront town of Wallace lies yards from property their great-grandparents bought more than a century ago. It's a historic area the sisters have dedicated themselves to keeping free of the heavy industry that lines the opposite shore of the Mississippi River. We have all these little pockets of free towns surrounding these plantation cane fields. It's such a great story of tenacity and how we were able to be financially independent and economically savvy, Joy Banner said. Today, miles of sugarcane borders homes on Wallace's west side. Eastward, two plantations tell the story of enslaved people. One has more than a dozen slave quarters, the other a memorial commemorating a slave revolt. Directly across the Mississippi, refineries and other heavy-duty industry crowd the view, showing Wallace residents exactly what the Banners are fighting against taking over their side of the river. Together, they created a nonprofit called the Descendants Project to preserve Black Louisianans' culture. The immediate goal is to stop a 222-acre proposed grain export facility from being built within 300 feet of the Banners' property and near several historic sites. It would essentially pave the way for the whole entire West Bank area that doesn't have any heavy industry on it to just be industrialized. We have a lot of heritage, and that's going to be decimated if we get these plants. Their sentiments echo those of residents who live in other towns along Louisiana's Cancer Alley, an 85-mile corridor along the Mississippi River between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. It's filled with industrial plants that emit toxic chemicals, including known carcinogens. The Descendants Project has tangled with Greenfield Louisiana LLC, the company proposing the grain terminal, as well as the local St. John the Baptist Parish Council for nearly 2 years, seeking to prevent the Greenfield Wallace Grain Export Facility from being built. It would receive and export grain byproducts via trucks, trains, and barges. While some town residents support the project, the Banners and other neighbors fear it will eradicate historic landmarks and pollute the area. "We already have issues with industry from the other side of the river," said Gail Zering, whose husband's family purchased their property in the late 19th century. To add to that, with a grain elevator is just piling it on. The parish council recently rezoned nearly 1,300 acres of commercial and residential property for heavy industry. "The only changes I've seen in my community are people leaving. We have absolutely nothing on our West Bank," said Willa Gordon, a lifelong resident. Community member Nicole Dumas said, "It automatically meant to me jobs coming into my community and economic development and growth, so I was very excited. I'm disappointed that years later it's still not here." Greenfield plans to create more than 1,000 jobs doing construction and 370 permanent positions once the site opens. The company also has promised to host local job fairs, training, and certification programs. Through their nonprofit, the Banners want to create a network of historic communities and economic opportunity. They recently moved a plantation house their ancestors once lived in to their property in hopes that it can be given a historical marker and of preventing any industrial building on their land. "We are doing what we can to protect and to hold on, but it's so crucial that we keep those plants out," Joe Banner said.
Using Food to Connect, Yellen is a Culinary Envoy by Alan Rappaport. There was mayonnaise mixed with ants at a gastronomic tapaya in Mexico City. The garlic at a Persian restaurant in Frankfurt was aged 25 years. And yes, the magic mushrooms in Beijing were hallucinogenic. This isn't an Anthony Bourdain travel show, but rather a taste of what Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has been eating on the road over the more than 300,000 miles she has logged over the last 3 years as she has been grappling with inflation and devising new ways to cripple the Russian economy. "It's not like it's a scheme to conduct some sort of diplomacy," Ms. Yellen, 77, said during an interview in June over scrambled eggs with onions and home fries at Sarge's Delicatessen and Diner in New York City. Nevertheless, it does seem to have that impact. Ms. Yellen's food adventures have become the subject of global fascination over the past year, with local and social media highlighting up about where and what she's been eating. The intrigue has been a surprising twist in the tenure of Ms. Yellen, an economist and former Federal Reserve chair who, unlike most previous Treasury secretary, prizes mixing in cultural experiences with the grind of government travel. Ms. Yellen once described her family meals as too rich with economic talk to be appetizing to most, but as Treasury secretary, she has been unleashing her inner Guy Fieri. She's a fan of the show Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. And beyond that, food adventures have become a way to connect with other officials and her staff while gaining a better understanding of local economies. Some of Ms. Yellen's most important moments on the job have involved breaking bread in Brussels. In 2021, she persuaded Pascal Donoghue, the Irish finance minister at the time, to join an international tax agreement over pastries at the Hotel Amigo. In 2022, Ms. Yellen gathered finance ministers from the Group of Seven Nations at the Treasury Department and ordered a chicken and salads. They had completed a plan to cap the price of Russian oil. Working dinners in China were more formal banquet meals where Chinese officials kept the wine flowing. On occasion, Ms. Yellen paced herself by inviting her undersecretary, Jay Shambaugh, to help swig some of the alcohol poured for her during the many toasts. At Sarger's, where she has eaten four times as Treasury Secretary, Ms. Yellen has greeted by a group of starstruck retired officials from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They asked her about interest rates and thanked her for her service. After she left, one described her as the bomb. The previous night, after receiving an award from the Economic Club of New York, Ms. Yellen and her staff headed to Sammy's Romanian Steakhouse for the family-style meal of meats. When the keyboardist kicked off the nightly tradition where patrons hold hand and dance the hora, Ms. Yellen got up and joined. "She's a trooper," said Rona Zimmerman, co-owner of Sammy's.
It is now 30 minutes after the hour. We'll return with more front pages for Monday, July 15, 2024, after these messages.
Here's news that should help the more than 16 million Americans with chronic respiratory diseases, such as COPD, breathe easier. Pulmonary rehab is a proven treatment that improves quality of life, reports the American Thoracic Society. People with such conditions are often limited in their daily activities, but a comprehensive 6 to 12 week program of supervised exercise, education, and support helps patients learn how to manage breathing so they not only feel better, but can do more in their everyday lives. Go to livebetter.org to learn more about pulmonary rehab and find nearby programs.
Welcome back to Front Pages for July 15th, 2024. And from the New York Times comes a story: Manhattan Borough President pushes pro-housing agenda through local boards, by Mira Zaviri. Solutions to the housing crisis often face a small but mighty roadblock. Local residents tend to restrict more development in their neighborhoods, and they typically have clout. This has been true in New York City, where groups of activists and civic leaders sitting on 59 community boards have earned a reputation for saying no to new housing. Now Mark Levin, the borough president of Manhattan, is trying to flip the narrative. He is using his power to appoint board members who are amenable to change and to replace those who would stand in the way. Of the more than 100 people he has appointed or reappointed, he characterized more than 80% as pro-housing, as determined by a questionnaire he gives them before they are chosen. His efforts have been contentious, with opponents accusing him of capitulating to the real estate industry, but his practices may already be having an effect. Community boards have an extremely important voice. In my office, this is the area where I have some direct levers to pull. Mr. Levin's push is yet another indicator of how a crushing housing crisis is reshaping New York City politics. A recent survey indicated that the city's shortage is the worst it has been in half a century, fueling a rise in the cost of living that could push rents to break records again this summer. Mayor Eric Adams and Governor Kathy Hochul have both backed major proposals to make it easier to build homes, the sort of ideas that have drawn opposition from community boards in the past. But on Monday, the chairs of Manhattan's community boards voted to support some key parts of the mayor's efforts. "What we're seeing is a rapidly shifting consensus toward pro-housing policies," said Anne-Marie Gray, the executive director of Open New York, a nonprofit that supports more development, has encouraged its members to apply to sit on community boards. "Community boards do not have any explicit power to reject development proposals, but they usually must be consulted. Their opinions, seen as a proxy for how voters might feel about the project, can influence the city council members who do have the power to approve or reject the proposals." Critics of the board say members are not actually representatives of the public. They do not always reflect their neighborhood's racial and ethnic diversity, and homeowners and older people tend to be overrepresentative. John Mudd, the president of Midtown South Community Council, a nonprofit group that supports tenants and works on other civic issues, says that stacking community boards with people who support development meant that the boards could prioritize profits. On Thursday, Mr. Mudd wrote a letter to state and city officials about the influence of developers and pro-housing groups. "They're circumventing what the community board was meant to be. They're going to destroy the city."
Grant aims to boost access to child care. A nonprofit network supporting home-based private childcare businesses in Fairfield and New Haven counties is expanding its work statewide thanks to a $250,000 grant. The quasi-public Connecticut Health and Educational Facilities Authority, also known as CHEFA, which provides financial support to educational institutions and healthcare organizations, announced it's made the award to All Our Kin, a national nonprofit that offers free business training and education support to thousands of family child care providers. All Our Kin intends to put the fund toward offering its classes in more rural and under-resourced regions of the state, including Eastern Connecticut, and helping home-based educators obtain national accreditation. Jessica Sager, chief executive of All Our Kin, said the grant will help the organization serve hundreds more educators. There are currently about 1,800 such businesses in Connecticut, each serving between 6 and 9 students, many of them infants and toddlers. Connecticut's families need quality child care. They need programs that work for their schedules and for the individual needs of their young children, Sager said. Family child care does just that. Lawrence Davis, chair of CHIFA's grant committee, called the grant a double win for the state of Connecticut's economy. Thousands of working parents in Connecticut require child care to be able to participate in the labor force. Davis sees CHIFA's partnership with All Our Kin as fostering an environment where educators are empowered to succeed, both as caregivers and business owners, he said. Expanding All Our Kin's programs ensures that the quality of child care throughout Connecticut is enhanced and educators are better equipped to manage and grow their business so that more families have access to this critical resource and the small business owners can thrive, he said. Still, quality child care, whether it's accessible or not, remains difficult for many families to afford. Expanding home-based child care capacity only addresses part of the problem. The legislature approved an additional $23.9 million in funding for child care this year, primarily designated for Care for Kids, a voucher program for lower-income families. That's a far cry from the estimated $150 million a blue ribbon panel convened by Governor Led Lamont had called for this year and a detailed strategic plan aimed at overhauling the struggling sector.
Colombia and its poor farmers face a new problem. Too much cocaine. Geneva Gatsby. For decades, one industry has sustained the small, remote Colombian village of Cano Cabra, Inc., and that was cocaine. Those who live in this community and the central part of the country rise early every morning to pick coca leaf, scraping brittle branches, sometimes until their hands bleed. Later, they mix the leaves with gasoline and other chemicals to make chalky white bricks of coca paste. But 2 years ago, the villagers said something alarming happened. The drug traffickers who buy the cocaine, buy the coca paste and turn it into cocaine stopped showing up. Suddenly, people who were already poor had no income. Food became scarce. An exodus to other parts of Colombia in search of jobs followed. The town of 200 shrunk to 40. The same pattern was repeated again and again in communities across the country where coca is the only source of income. Colombia, the global nexus of the cocaine industry, where Pablo Escobar became the world's best-known criminal and which still produces more of the drug than any other nation, is facing tectonic shifts as a result of domestic and global forces that are reshaping the drug industry. The changing dynamics have led to blocks of unsold coca paste piling up across Colombia. The purchase of the paste is more than half of the country's coca-growing regions have dropped precipitously or disappeared completely, spurring a humanitarian crisis in many remote, impoverished communities. The drug market has never been in such a dramatic turndown, said Felipe Tacan, an economist who has studied the illicit drug economy and directed a national government program to help more coca farmers to legal drugs. The upending of the cocaine industry is in part an unintended consequence of a landmark peace deal 8 years ago with the country's largest armed group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, which ended one phase of a conflict that had lasted decades. The leftist group financed its war largely through cocaine and relied on thousands of farmers to provide the bright green coca plant, the drug's main ingredient. And once the FARC exited the cocaine industry, it was replaced by smaller criminal groups of pursuing a new economic model. Leonardo Correa of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, buying large quantities of coca from a smaller number of farmers and limiting their operation to border regions where it is easier to move drugs out of the country. That means towns like Cano Cabra, deep in the country's interior, about 165 miles southeast of Bogota, the capital, have seen their local sole business largely vanish. Several regions have achieved economic development thanks to the coca and cocaine industry, said Diego Garcia Divas, who manages the drug policy program of the Open Society Foundation. What income will replace coca? Another illegal income? Mining, trafficking of humans, wildlife, timber, extortion? In many remote areas of Colombia, it is not economically viable to sell other crops because of high transportation costs. By the time produce arrives at market, it would rot, residents said. For many Colombians, the cocaine industry has been their only option. It does harm the humanity, and we are aware of that, but for us it means health, it means education, it means the sustenance of the families in the regions.
State planning for passive park design at historic site. The state is seeking public input to help it with the design of the passive park concept as it makes plans for Seaside State Park, according to the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, also known as DEEP. DEEP said the plans for Seaside in Waterford include $7.1 million committed to implement the passive park concept that is intended to improve waterfront access along the Long Island Sound for visitors and protect the site from coastal flooding. DEEP is thrilled to continue to move forward in the planning process around Seaside State Park, DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes said in the statement. Engaging with stakeholders to inform the passive park concept will help us commemorate the historic buildings as we work to bring Seaside up to the standard of our other state parks and provide residents with an improved, unique, and beautiful opportunity to access one of our greatest assets, the Connecticut shoreline. The passive park concept was identified as an option in the comprehensive planning process in which DEEP engaged with local leaders, community members, and stakeholders, the agency said in a statement. Through the passive park concept, the deteriorated buildings on site will be removed, and site improvements, including restrooms, walking trails, shoreline improvements, picnic areas, parking improvements, features to memorialize and commemorate the architecture and historic significance of the site, and other elements will be implemented, the agency said. The major buildings on site were designed by Cass Gilbert, the architect who also designed the Woolworth Building in New York City and the U.S. Supreme Court Building in Washington, D.C. The alternative would be to tear down the 1930s-era structures, which have 173,000 square feet of space, the Current has reported. The site once housed the Seaside Sanatorium for children with tuberculosis. The facility was later used to serve children and adults with developmental disabilities. The agency said it has been working with a consultant, FHI Studio, to meet with various local stakeholder groups and is now seeking public participation in a survey to inform the historical commemoration of the buildings that will be removed, learn what activities or features visitors might like to see in the park, and better understand how the site is currently used.
Burns from scorching hot pavement are on the rise and can be fatal, by Adele Sasson and Isabel Taft. Stephen Cantwell remembers betting on horses races at a Las Vegas casino, drinking tequila in celebration of his wins, and walking to a nearby restaurant for hibachi rice. On the way there, Mr. Cantwell, 59, passed out on the sidewalk. The high temperature on that day, June 21st, was 109 degrees, but the ground beneath him was more likely dozens of degrees hotter. By the time he had regained consciousness in a hospital, the pavement had seared his skin, even through his clothing, he said. It gave him second- to third-degree burns to about 10% of his body, an arm, a shoulder, his left buttock, and part of his leg. It was very painful, absolutely, he said, though he recovered well after 2 weeks of treatment at the University Medical Center in Las Vegas. As climate change pushes summer temperatures ever higher and for longer stretches, and with more Americans moving into rapidly expanding cities of the Southwest, more people are suffering serious burns from contact with hot outdoor surfaces. For some, the burns are so extensive that they prove fatal, according to burn experts. In 2022, the Arizona Burn Center at Valleywise Health Medical Center in Phoenix, the largest burn center in the Southwest, admitted 85 patients for contact burns over the summer. Last year, Phoenix sweltered through 31 straight days of temperatures above 110 degrees. That number climbed to 136 patients, 14 of whom died. This year, the center has already treated 50, and four of those have died. Your body just literally sits there and cooks. When someone finally finds you, you're already in multi-system organ failure. The heat wave that broiled the Southwest this past week shifted east over the weekend. Temperatures are expected to soar in the Midwest on Monday, with the heat index rising to triple-digit figures in places like Kansas City, Missouri. Further east, New York City's temperature is expected to peak in the mid-90s. For children, the hot surfaces can be a source both of fascination for frying eggs, baking cookies, melting crayons, and also painful lessons. And even the pursuit of a place to cool off can come with risks, as Jed Bednar, 10, of Las Vegas, learned on a recent visit to a friend's house for a swim. The ride was uncomfortable, the car at first feeling hotter than the outside air, and even when the few steps from the house to the pool, like they singed the bottom of his feet. It was so hot, it burned our feet, and we ran to the pool. Kevin Foster, the director of the Arizona Burn Center, said, "Almost all of these burns are preventable with a little bit of forethought." He recommends not going out during the hottest part of the day. If it can be avoided, making sure someone knows where you're going or taking someone with you. Staying hydrated is paramount, he said.
It is now 45 minutes after the hour. We'll be back with more of Front Pages for Monday, July 15, 2024, after these messages.
Hearing loss is a common problem of getting older, but exposure to loud noises can affect people of all ages. One in five Americans over the age of 12 have hearing loss. Loud environments at work or leisure events, such as concerts and ball games, or the use of listening devices can all cause permanent damage to the sensitive structures of the inner ear. Use earplugs in a noisy workplace and limit exposure to excessively loud events and environments to help prevent hearing loss at a young age and slow its progression as we get older. Regular screenings can also detect problems early. Thank you for joining us on A Minute of Health with CDC.
For the most accurate health information, visit cdc.gov or call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
Welcome back to Front Pages for Monday, July 15th, 2024. Our next story is titled China Hoes Concave to Strategize on Economy by Chris Buckley and Keith Ratcher. Xi Jinping, China's leader, and 370 or so other Communist Party officials will assemble in Beijing starting Monday, away from the public eye, to review a plan intended to shake the world's second biggest economy out of its malaise. Mr. Xi will sit in the front of the conference hall, most likely in the Jixix Hotel, a 60-year-old institution with Soviet-style architecture, and the party loyalists arrayed before him are near certain to acclaim his plans during the four-day meeting. The real changes in policy or ideology filter through the layer of governments. Success or failure will largely turn on whether Mr. Xi is able to win renewed confidence from the wider Chinese population, as well as foreign investors who have grown disenchanted with his policies. China's businesses and consumers have suffered in recent years through a stumbling growth, a property sector meltdown, and a plight of debt among local governments. Foreign companies have recoiled from a market they once clamored to enter. A lot of uncertainty feeds into very low consumer sentiment, very low investor sentiment, Bert Hoffman, a former World Bank country director for China, said in a talk this month about the meeting. There's a point in time where China needs to show its cards. Party leaders are orchestrating the conclave, the so-called third plenum of the Central Committee, as a stage to promote strategies for what Mr. Xi calls high-quality growth. In recent history, third plenum meetings, named for their place in the five-year cycle of committee sessions, were when Chinese leaders like Xi Jinping ignited enthusiasm for their modernization goals. Mr. Xi has been here before. He started a detailed program for reforms at the third plenum in 2013, but by many measures, the promised economic and social changes remain incomplete. This time, experienced economists are tempering expectations of big changes in course for Mr. Xi. Many people have great expectations for the third plenum, looking toward another wave of reforms and major moves. Yao Yang, the professor of economics at Peking University, said in a speech to Chinese business executives last month, "I want to tell you all that's taking a lot for granted."
Fatal motorcycle crashes on rise. Fatal motorcycle crashes in Connecticut so far this year have nearly doubled what they were about halfway through the year 5 years ago, and have eclipsed what they were at this time last year. Fatalities attributed to motorcycle crashes have been on the rise since 2019 and have shown no signs of decreasing, according to Charles C. Grasso III, a retired police sergeant who serves as a fatal crash data liaison and accident reconstructionist at the UConn Transportation Safety Research Center. The peak is right now through probably September, Grasso said, adding that the data shows a grim outlook for the summer months ahead. According to UConn's Connecticut Crash Data Repository, as of July 10th, there have been 36 fatalities involving motorcycle crashes compared to only 19 at the same time in 2019. At about the halfway mark of 2020, 31 fatal motorcycle crashes had been reported, followed by 37 in 2021, 34 in 2022, and 23 in 2023 during the same time period. The number of motorcycle fatalities so far in 2024 puts the state on pace to surpass last year's total of 58 deaths, according to the crash statistics. In 2019, 48 people died in the Nutmeg State, which was followed by 62 in 2020 and 66 in both years, 2021 and 2022. I think we are concerned when looking at these numbers, Grasso said, but I do believe as a whole, and this is not a Connecticut issue, it's a nationwide issue. From talking to my colleagues around the country, overall speed is up. The overall crash speeds from cars, motorcycles, anything is dramatically up. I'm seeing many crashes near 100 miles an hour. Grasso said he believes increased speed among motorcycle drivers and other motorists can be attributed to several different factors. During the pandemic, he said it was widely known that police were avoiding traffic stops when possible to reduce COVID-19 exposure instances, and that because many people were working from home, the roads were often very empty. So you could drive a lot faster because people weren't commuting and they just got used to the speeds, Grasso said, adding that motorists who became accustomed to driving faster did not appear to slow down once more vehicles returned to the roadways.
TV's Clown Prince of Fitness, Kept Us Sweating by Alex Traub. Richard Simmons, who with dances, confessions, speeches, comedy sketches, and pep talks, established himself as America's most popular fitness instructor, died on Saturday at his home in L.A. He was 76. A representative for Mr. Simmons, Tom Esty, confirmed the death. The Los Angeles Police and Fire Departments responded to Mr. Simmons' address at 10 a.m. on Saturday. A fire department spokesman said the personnel there determined he had died of natural causes. In March, Mr. Simmons said he had been treated for basal cell carcinoma, which he said first appeared as a strange-looking bump under the eye. From the 1980s until his death, Mr. Simmons was the dominant incarnation of long-standing figures from American pop culture, dating at least to the muscle show Impresario and magazine publisher Bernard McFadden. Mr. Simmons shared much with Jack LaLanne. Each man became a television and self-help sensation by promoting a personal story of being born again, a miserable youth of sinful junk food gluttony, followed by a discovery that physical fitness confers happiness and virtue. I think I'm just a good example of a chubby, fat, unhappy kid who lived in New Orleans, Louisiana, and dreamed, and now all my dreams are coming true, Mr. Simmons told the TV host Uel Hauser in 1980. In 2017, Mr. Simmons was the subject of Missing Richard Simmons, which became the most downloaded podcast on iTunes. It discussed theories, some of them outlandish, about what had happened to him. Its host, Dan Taberlisk, told The Times in 2017 that the show came from a place of love and real concern, but in review, The Times critic Amanda Hess labeled it an invasion of privacy masquerading as a love letter. Whatever the ethics of Missing Mr. Simmons, the show's popularity testified to something else. How many Americans felt disbelief, even sadness, at the thought of Richard Simmons experiencing anything other than the joy he had become known for?
Higher Hartford prepares for recruitment training as submarine construction set to expand workforce. The U.S. Navy will be in East Hartford on Monday to start a discussion on a Capital Region jobs program to recruit candidates who can contribute to the Pentagon's aggressive submarine construction goals an hour to the southeast at the Electric Boat Shipyard in Groton. The jobs discussion is part of the Navy's multi-billion dollar drive to accelerate shipyard production and replace its aging submarine fleet in the face of aggressive Chinese naval expansion in the Indo-Pacific and evolving security threats elsewhere. The jobs and production push already has resulted in a remarkable workforce expansion at Electric Boat's shipyards in Groton and Quonset Point, Rhode Island. Electric Boat, a division of General Dynamics, hired and trained more than 5,000 over each of the last 2 years and another 2,500 over the first 6 months of 2024. With the prospect of billions of dollars of Virginia and Columbia-class submarine contracts extending for decades, Electric Boat said it plans to continue hiring at the same rate for the foreseeable future. Discussion of the jobs and training program, which will be known as Hire Hartford, will be hosted at the Connecticut Center for Advanced Technology in East Hartford by U.S. Representatives John Larson and Joe Courtney, an influential voice in naval affairs as ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee's Sea Power Subcommittee. In attendance will be representatives of the Navy Submarine Industrial Base Team, Electric Boat, local companies involved in the submarine construction supply chain, and state-affiliated training and jobs placement organizations. The program has the potential to provide hundreds of skilled, high-paying, and long-term manufacturing jobs to Hartford area workers. The jobs and training plan is expected to be similar to a model the Navy used in Providence and will likely involve a partnership with technical high schools, something already underway in southeastern Connecticut. Electric Boat and the Navy are finding that it is a challenge to ramp up production after decades of flat post-Cold War defense spending that shrunk the U.S. fleet by half while idling and eventually depleting the ranks of welders, shipfitters, and riggers who build ships, not to mention the companies that supply materials and components. It is now 55 minutes after the hour. Let's take a look at our lottery numbers. Lottery figures for Sunday, July 14th. Play 3-day 050 Wild Ball 2. Play 4-day 2573 Wild Ball 0. The Play 3 night and Play 4 night numbers were not available. Saturday's late numbers: Play 3 night 625 Wild Ball 5. Play 4 night 2758 Wild Ball 8. Cash 5, 2, 8, 11, 15, 29. Lucky for life: 8, 16, 27, 38, 34, Lucky Ball 10. Tuesday's estimated lotto jackpot, $4.5 million. Tuesday's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $226 million. And tonight's estimated Powerball jackpot is $54 million. The late lotto numbers were not drawn in time for this edition. You'll need to visit current.com/lottery for those numbers. That's all for this edition of The Front Pages. We've been reading from today's Hartford Current and New York Times. Your readers have been Lou Mirando and Arlene Ford. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11 p.m.